It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go, off and running for this, the 15th day of October 2019. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. And that's also where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room in the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, and all time zones in between. And on the either side, you know, whatever. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. If you jump into the chat room, you'll be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and Squeaky, early arrivers to the program and to the chat room, and capably moderated. And there's Jimmy in the Great Northwest just popping by. You'll also be capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has folded space today to become Man Cave, because they're looking for rain out that way, but no clouds have folded space, no water-laden clouds into Sparky's general area. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa. We are hot on both decks aboard the USS Trumptanic. The rats are jumping overboard, even as we speak, and they don't call them rat lines for nothing. But as Brother Deacon Asa alludes, it is Trumptanic Tuesday, and we have, in my father's house are many Morans. In many ways, Trumptanic Tuesday is a carryover from Moran Monday. Thanks go out. This program begins with gratitude every evening. Thanks go out to Darlene in Connecticut and Robert in California. Thank you both for being subscribers and partial sponsors of the program. I guess that means that maybe, like, the 15th of the month is now the official loneliest day of the for subscribers, with only two. But two is ever so important as compared to zero. Thank you, Darlene, and thank you, Robert. And thanks again, or not thanks again, but profound thanks to an anonymous contributor who, knowing what's been going on in our family, has helped make it possible, when the time comes that I can do it, for me to go Ferg's bail. Thank you very, very kindly indeed, anonymous contributor. I cannot express profoundly enough how much we do thank you for that. As far as fundraising goes on the program, thanks to Earther, who last night at the very end of the program met Steve in New York's challenge. We've only got 345 to go to make it to even for this evening. Make it to even for the more or less halfway mark of October. So that's where it stands. If you want to help out, run over to headon.live, click on the contribute tab, and the PayPal interface is right there. If you'd like to become a subscriber, you know how that works. You'll be giving up something less than a half of a five-stick pack of juicy fruit if you decide to support the horn to the tune of about $10 a month. Because, well, one program works out to somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, a little over 40 cents. And the last I checked, the cheapest thing in the checkout there at the local big box store or the local grocery store was a 5-stick pack of Wrigley's gum coming in at a cool dollar. So everything is a sacrifice, but if you want to help keep independent, progressive, commercial-free, non-capitalist radio running, that 2.5 sticks of gum, it goes a long, long way. Whereas chewing gum loses its flavor on the bedpost overnight. And I'm going to, I'm just going to say a little something here. I'm not pogo sticking up onto the cross because there are a lot of people in a lot worse shape all over this country. But I continue to hear from you talking about similar circumstances you have been through. And I don't think we fully understand the brutality of the system until we find ourselves in it. So today, Ferg enters his third week of incarceration. You might recall this nightmare began on October the 1st. And there's not a lot of change. Some, but not a lot. I can finally have contact with him. We've made that much progress. But there are still underlying criminal charges that have to be addressed. Two or three of them. And as far as, you know, his mother has done the all the heavy lifting as far as contact and communication is concerned, because I didn't want his situation to get worse by talking to me. I'm waiting to hear whether or not he has been signed on, for lack of a better term, to Medicaid. Waiting for that to go through. No reason he shouldn't be, but, well. And that will change some things. But he's still in a position where he can't come home and he has nowhere to go. And he is scared. And alone. And dealing with some of the less savory elements of hillbilly society. His situation is far worse than his mother's and mine. We're at least at home. But I can say that I've never been through anything like this in my life. I went through the death of my mother, and then 10 years later, the death of my father. And I miss them both dearly every day. I've never stopped. Because their presence in my life, though they are gone, endures. I see them in my dreams. But I have never, ever endured anything that has taken a toll like this. Where one once, and you know, it's one of those things where you appreciate the genius of Shakespeare. And Hamlet complaining about not even being able to find peace in sleep. I could be bounded in a nutshell, he said, and count myself
a king of infinite space were it not that I have bad dreams. The physical after effects of the grappling and wrestling and scuffling that went on 15 days ago continues to manifest in me. I think I pulled a bunch of muscles. Got a headache that won't go away. In many ways, it reminds me, although distantly, it reminds me of those blistering hot days of August when I was a teenager trying very poorly to play football. I'd pulled a muscle in my back, and you know, you gotta play through the pain, boy. Son, you gotta play through it. Get up, walk it off, rub some dirt on it. And so I remember one particular day, it was in the 90s. Practice was 3 hours long in the height of the heat of the day. And they had us driving the blocking sled for what seemed forever. And you felt like you just couldn't put one more foot in front of the other to drive that godforsaken sled with a coach standing on the back of it even another inch. But nonetheless, you had to. And this reminds me of that. Because every day, these 3 hours are a refuge of sort for me. And you've told me that, many of you have told me that they are for you as well. And so this represents, like, for instance, last Friday on the front porch, a chance to put it all aside and focus on things outside ourselves. But I have never, ever had anything take place that makes getting from one day to the next, putting one foot in front of the other, more of a challenge. So that's where things stand. And again, I don't say this as a poor, poor, pitiful me, but just as a way of maybe addressing a problem in ways that other members of the media might not. And I continue to try to be here every evening because I think it's good for me. And I hope for you as well. And maybe good to just try to focus a little bit, but God almighty, to be confronted with a problem that has seemingly no solution, or the solutions one attempts come to nothing. And not because it's a criminal matter. I mean, the criminal justice system is involved, but the problems that extend beyond that of trying to find help in a brutal mental health system. God, God, God. Thank you, Kyle. Kyle says, I'm well aware that words from a person you only know through correspondence via a radio show can't help your situation right now. But just know that we're on your side, Agnes's side, on Ferg's side, for him to get better and for you to find some peace and a happy ending in this battle you're fighting. You're not alone in this. Thank you, Kyle. And that's why I mentioned this. I want this program to be a place where, although we clown around and cuss and discuss, where we are deeply engaged in the reality-based community. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. Sometimes it just feels like the front of my brain is going to come right out through my forehead. And wow. And somewhere along the way, I'm not, you know, I certainly feel no shame in saying it. I think I'm probably going to need a little counseling. Because this is just grinding. And where I had sympathy before and empathy before, it is pressed down and shaken together, as the saying goes, for anyone who has to live through something like this. Steve in New York says two things. Jesus Christ, Bob. Stop apologizing for wearing your heart on your sleeve and telling us what's going on. After all, isn't that what family does? Tell each other what's going on and seeking support? Yeah, they do. And I feel like I would be somehow false if I continued each evening being here and pretending like nothing was wrong, because so much is. Everything, every waking moment, every breath is impacted by this. I feel, you know, Agnes has said to me that she can feel herself the fears and anxieties and pains of our children. And I believe her. And just where I'm concerned, it feels like It feels like, I don't know how to describe it, like braided life force. Like lives are braided together in an ongoing strand. Interesting that the ancient Greeks conceptualized deities, female deities, goddesses, whose purpose was to spin out the yarn of frail human lives, the way that a woman by the hearth in that era would spin thread out from raw wool. Maybe they were onto something. Were those the Furies, or the Furries? I can't recall. Pretty sure it wasn't the Muses. And thank you, Steve, who just initiated another $15 challenge. If somebody will meet that, Steve will double it. Somebody puts up $15, Steve will double it, and that'll take us down to $315 if it's met. And another member of the fraternity of Steve from Georgia Stan, says, I'll always have your back, brother. Thank you, Steve. Thank you immensely. And thank you all. I should probably stop this. Navel-gazing and get to the business of the program, because it's pageant night in America. I saw an article from a publication called The Conversation earlier this afternoon, and there was a it was written by a professor at Vanderbilt University who teaches debate as a formal course. The author says, and it's John P. Koch, senior lecturer and director of debate at Vandy. I'm a communications scholar who directs the debate program at Vanderbilt University. Here's what I teach my students about debate. First, the process involves participants engaging each other on a specific topic. They must answer and question each other's arguments. Second, it involves arguments for and against a given proposition related to a topic. For example, college debaters may debate a proposition such as The United States federal government should substantially increase statutory restrictions on the war power authority of the President of the United States. And they occur within an agreed-upon format that gives participants a chance to advocate for and defend their positions. And notes that that is exactly what doesn't happen in things like what we will witness later this evening and which has been breathlessly talked about all day long among the multimillionaires of the for-profit media. Brother Deacon Asa, by the way, sent me a message saying that Shepherd Smith, whom we discussed, I guess, late last week, and who apparently was not, they say, was not forced out as a result of the machinations of Bill Barr to prosecution, sitting down for a talk with the greatest disaster in American immigration history, Rupert Murdoch, first by a nose, ahead of the other greatest immigration disaster in the modern history of the United States, Elaine Chao. Are they rich? Let them in. Yeah, what do you mean they got no morals? What do you mean they got no scruples? What do you mean they're ethically bankrupt? Fuck it, they got money. Let them in. Murka. But Professor Koch here says that presidential debates aren't debates at all. They're joint press conferences. And I understand his point, but I disagree. I'm standing by my assessment of these entertainments? These tableaux? These pageants? Because, see, a joint press conference doesn't have massive staging. It doesn't have massive props. It doesn't have cameras that pan and swing and show the audience and does close-ups and pulls back for a wide shot when it's time to go to break. And most importantly, they don't have breaks. They do not have interruptions in the stream of thought whose only purpose is to deliver the audience from one corporation unto the tender mercies of another corporation for the purpose of separating said audience from its money, otherwise known as the profit motive, otherwise known as capitalism. And I don't know if they think this that deeply about these things within the campaigns, but for instance, and this, I mean, this is not a, it is specific, but it's not done for ill will. You got Bernie out there who says he's decidedly not a capitalist, and the rest of them eagerly are, and, well, there he'll stand on that capitalist stage helping advance the advertising philosophies and advertising strategies of whoever it is that's going to be running ads on this pageant. You know, there are just some things in our body politic, in our social contract that should not be tainted by the profit motive. Clean air. Clean water. The ability to go to the doctor when you're sick. And I think, as importantly as any of those, our very political process itself. Pete Buttigieg had a smart-ass comment blow up in his face. He gave an interview to some political podcast and derided the fundraising strategies of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who you know, raise their campaign cash to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, which they then give to media outlets that despise them, everything they stand for, and everyone who supports them. Pete Buttigieg derided that, saying, "We're not going to beat Trump with nickels and dimes." Well, the thing is, those nickels and dimes represent the hopes and aspirations of people who just don't happen to have tens of millions of dollars to flush down the toilet, but can part with a fin once in a while. But still, those monies are given to media outlets that despise us. Because I will reiterate, as we watch these things, and watch them we do, that these are exercises in rampant, cynical capitalism by which these individuals give money to people who largely hate them and everything they stand for. You'll recall that Les Moonves didn't say Bernie Sanders may not be good for America, but he's great for CBS. He said Donald Trump may not be good for America, but he's great for CBS. And you may rest assured that every other network feels the same way. One hopes and one gets a sense and one hopes that maybe these latest allegations coming from Ronan Farrow about the sleazy business at the very highest levels of the NBC News department may finally make a difference there. Bless his heart, and I mean that sincerely, not sarcastically, I give real credit to Chris Hayes, who had the nerve, the guts, to call out the high brass at NBC News, who looked the other way regarding all manner of sleazy filth perpetrated by Harvey Weinstein, and spiked Ronan Farrow's investigative work. Let's check in with Chris here.
In this show, I've been watching with increasing horror and bafflement as the NBA has enforced a kind of silence and speech code on its players and management for fear of offending the Chinese government and Chinese basketball fans. After a single tweet in support of the Hong Kong protesters by a Houston Rockets executive, the NBA has scrambled to lock down any other signs of criticism of the Chinese government, hoping to preserve access to an extremely lucrative and growing market for the sport. Now, of course, this kind of shying away from confrontation, choosing the path of least resistance, quite familiar in the news because it's what so many Republican members of Congress do every day when confronted with the bile, bigotry, and rank corruption and abuse of power with a man who's the head of their party. But it's important to note that it is not limited to them. In fact, the insidious destructive force of the path of least resistance is everywhere you look. Heck, I feel the tug of it myself as my own news organization is embroiled in a very public controversy over its conduct. As you've probably seen in his new book, Catch and Kill, my former colleague Ronan Farrow contends that NBC News slow-walked and then ultimately killed his reporting on Harvey Weinstein's sexual harassment and assault because it was intimidated by Weinstein and didn't want to cross him. Most distressingly, Farrow suggests NBC News was worried about the allegations of sexual assault and harassment against Matt Lauer coming out as a result of reporting on Weinstein and desperately wanted to avoid that. In Farrell's view, he was unable to break through what was effectively a conspiracy of silence from NBC News management. Now, NBC News vigorously denies this account. The president of NBC News, Noah Wappenheim, called Farrell's book a conspiracy theory in a memo sent out today, citing an internal NBC investigation that concluded that the extremely upsetting allegations against Lauer were not known internally at NBC. NBC has called any suggestion it did know false and offensive. Oppenheim and others have also maintained since Farrell's departure 2 years ago, the Weinstein story was never broadcast because it lacks sufficient on-the-record sourcing, even after NBC supported Farrell's assignment for 7 months. One thing, though, is indisputable. Ronan Farrow walked out of NBC News after working on the Weinstein story, and within 2 months published an incredible article, The New Yorker, that not only won a Pulitzer, but helped trigger a massive social and cultural reckoning that continues to this day. It is the kind of journalism that you want to do as a journalist, that everyone who works in this business should want to facilitate. Of course, there's a reason it took so long for the true story about Weinstein to be told, for the many allegations of him to stay locked in a vault. And that's because time and again, the path of least resistance for those with power was to not cross Weinstein or his army of friends and lawyers. Same goes for the many, many, many other powerful predators that we've come to know about. The path of least resistance is always there, beckoning seductively with an entirely plausible cover story. You've got bigger fish to fry. This isn't the hill to die on. The story isn't ready. But of course, it's the very ease of that path that makes it the enemy, the kind of work that we as journalists are supposed to do.
Pretty powerful, huh? Steve in New York points out, I'm going to be a bit crude because the word guts for me didn't quite say it. I'm going to go so far as to say Chris Hayes had balls for what he did in raking the people who sign his paycheck over the coals. Hopefully there will be no repercussions against him. But if I was a betting man, I wouldn't bet that way. But his point about the path of least resistance is well taken, but I don't think it touches everything. The bottom line, unless you firewall off your news division and pour money into it without regard to fear or favor, and fund it without regard to how much money it's generating back, well, the profit motive will always pollute the efforts. For God's sakes, Edward R. Murrow knew this as far back as the 50s, when he was doing battle with Paley, to try to maintain something resembling integrity inside CBS News. You know, the old saying, Lord Acton, wasn't it, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, can be paraphrased. A word which, incidentally, Nitwit Nero doesn't understand. For instance, he doesn't understand that Adam Schiff was paraphrasing him when he said, I'm only going to say this seven times, etc., etc. But you can paraphrase Lord Acton to say that wealth corrupts and massive wealth corrupts massively. And so they swan around in a high dollar bubble, a bubble made of billions, if not trillions, of dollars. And they nod, and they nudge, and they wink. And they quietly chuckle about the rest of us. You know, the rubes. I saw earlier today that there's a movie coming out now. I think it's called Bombshell. It features Margot Robbie, Nicole Kidman, and Charlize Theron as the Fox attack blondes who finally broke the code of silence, the omerta, over at Fox News TV Radio Rwanda. The makeup job on what appears to be John Lithgow playing Roger Ailes is amazing. And for all that it's, I guess, a compelling story about sexual harassment, it's still a story about a toxic culture at Fox. But Fox is not the only broadcast culture that is toxic. You'll notice in the memo cited by Chris Hayes They absolutely denied knowing anything about Matt Lauer, yada, yada, yada. He didn't mention them saying anything about not actually killing Ronan Farrow's work. Another case of that silence between the note and between the notes being music, too. Remember what happened to Phil Donahue, says Flavio. Yeah. And, of course, they've been rumoring because Andy Lack at MSNBC and NBC doesn't much like Chris Hayes at all. They've been rumoring Chris's program's demise for years now. And all he does is keep on succeeding. But there was Shepard Smith and his $15 million a year. Why wouldn't you walk? Leaving bought him some semblance of his own self-respect, his own dignity. But tonight, and for the podcast, I'm sure this dates the podcast, and I apologize for that. But if you watch the pageant, and if you watch it live and watch it all the way through, take note of some of those moments, like when the cameras go swirling around the room or pan back to show the crowd and the performers on the stage, and there's a vacuous voiceover from some millionaire from CNN, or maybe the New York Times. They're in on this, too, this evening. That should make for some delicious both-siderism. And they say, when we come back, foreign policy. In a pitchy sort of carnival sideshow barker approach to the most pressing issues of our day. Darlene in Connecticut says, believe it or not, Tulsi Gabbard was the only candidate who recently threatened to boycott the next debate because of everything you're talking about here, Bob. Don't know if she carried through on it. No, she said she'll be there now. I didn't know she qualified, but... Yeah. Darlene says, I harbor some hope that Bernie will say something tonight while on the stage instead of during the after-debate interviews. It would be nice, but... A magician never likes it when somebody in the audience hollers out, hey, the ace of spades is on a spring up his sleeve. And nobody on air ever criticizes the stupid ads that run between the segments. If that was the case, somebody would have said something by now about the Trump ad that ran, for instance, in football games on NBC and Morning Joe on NBC. Somebody would have been morally incensed by it. But you never say anything about the money. So pay attention to how this thing is presented. Look at the carnival atmosphere and just maybe keep notes, jot down a note here and there to see who it is that's doing the advertising on this pageant tonight. Or any night, every night that there's a pageant. Oh, and by the way, the maggots will be flying an airplane, I guess, with a banner message over the venue. I guess they couldn't find a skywriter to write Surrender Dorothy. Did you ever wonder if the Wicked Witch got violently airsick after skywriting that? I mean, that had to be rough. But that's just a starting place for the evening. It's been all Hunter Biden all day long as that stupid story continues to get legs because the for-profit media wants it to have legs. out there yammering away. Angela Rye, I think, is her name, complained a little bit on CNN about persisting in the story. But Allison and the guy who sits next to her were hell-bent on continuing to discuss it. Eventually, they managed to actually mention the filthy financial dealings of Beavis and Butthead and Princess Daddy Wanka. The word had apparently gone out in Republican circles because even Ronna Romney McDaniel tweeted about Hunter Biden and claimed it was swampy and more obvious nepotism. I know, probably should have at least offered a hockey puck advisory. But yes, Ronna Romney McDaniel, who is the chair of the GOP, complained about nepotism today. For the hearing impaired, that's Ronna Romney McDaniel. Romney! Nepotism! Uncle Bishop Willard, Mitt, Thanksgiving dinner, pass the giblet gravy, please, Uncle Mitt. When in point of fact, if Willard Romney was not Willard Romney, Ronna McDaniel would be among that class of people like Meghan McCain, who would probably be swabbing toilets on the midnight shift at the fucking Waffle House. She's upset about nepotism. Ronna is. And then, that wasn't enough. Because Rand Paul and that thing on his head, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, who's comfortably well off, got real squirmy and uncomfortable. When he was questioned about blathering about Hunter Biden, he was interviewed over on MSNBC. And if nothing else, yeah, hockey puck warning, but this is some pretty high comedy. Or low farce, depending on how you view it.
You should, if you want to be fair, investigate Hunter Biden's economic dealings in the Ukraine as well.
Does that mean we should be looking deeper into how Jared Kushner's family got foreign money for 666 Fifth Avenue? How Ivanka Trump got 13 trademarks from the Chinese government? How she was able to expand her brand since the president took office? I mean, yeah, giddy up.
If we want to go down the road of the politics of self-destruction of everybody, criminalize all politicians on both sides of the aisle and go after their family, yes, we can do that. But both sides are doing that. Nobody really should excuse themselves and say, oh, we're holier than thou and Trump is evil.
Well, yeah, you kind of should, Randy. Because, again, here's a guy who, if his daddy hadn't been Ron Paul, who amassed a fortune sending out a racist newsletter for decades while serving as a member of the House of Representatives, this guy would not be a libertarian ophthalmologist and comfortably well off, and he damn sure wouldn't be a member of the Senate of the United States. He, too, would be probably working the midnight shift at some Waffle House somewhere, because nobody's ever going to accuse Rand Paul of being a towering intellect. Because there just aren't that many of them there in the Senate, in the Republican Congress. You might even go so far as to say that they are, in fact, Well, dullards. And you could hear Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, getting squirmy. He was just going to slime all he was going to do is slime all over Hunter Biden, who interestingly is not and has not been a member of the government of the United States, like, you know, Princess Daddy Wanka. Who got those patents that Stephanie Ruhle mentioned, literally after sitting down to din-din at that vermin-infested filth pit Mar-a-Lago with President Xi Jinping of China. And how is it the politics of self-destruction, which in itself is word salad, to investigate corruption inside the government of the United States? Yep, by the way, Romney McDaniel didn't have much to say either about Iwanka and Beavis and Butthead. And Jared. Oh, hell no. Sorry. Not happening. All you gotta do is pay attention, and these people will out themselves. But it is Trump-tanic Tuesday. And therefore, it is a day for looking out for the likes of the Ronna Romney McDaniels and the Rand Paul libertarian ophthalmologists. But also, there are some second-tier titanic intellects out there. Over at that news channel, for the people who think that Fox is just a bunch of sissy liberals. I'm talking about Onan, who spilled his seed upon the ground. No, not, it's O-Ann, not Onan. I'm sorry, I confused the deliberate Old Testament masturbator with these people who spend every broadcast hour doing basically the same thing for Donald Trump. One America News Network. And they've got an attack blonde by the name of Liz Wheeler. Oh, and by the way, thank you very kindly to Anatole. Thank you, Anatole, for meeting Steve's challenge this evening and adding a little bit to it. We've now only got $305 to go to catch up and be even as we move into the second half of October. Thank you. What's that? Megan says, Republican nepotism, the likes of Ronna Romney McDaniel, Rand Paul, Meghan McCain, and others all need to be looked in the eye, told to sit down and shut up. It's clear when they open their mouths, they know not of which they speak. Oh, they know. They're just protecting their class. They're guarding their buzzard's roost. And if you've ever been in the woods and happened, say, within a quarter mile of a buzzard's roost, you'll know just how nasty they are. Thank you, Glenn. Glenn in New York says, I'm with you. Hope you find some peace in these shitty times. I never know what to say, but I'm pulling for some, any solace for you and Agnes. Thank you. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you so very much. It means a ton. So yesterday, as I briefly discussed on the program, was what used to be referred to as Columbus Day, and still is in some quarters, though eventually we hope for civilization to catch up with us and we can disappear that holiday. But Liz Wheeler, the attack blonde over at Onan, she wasn't having any of it. Now, Wheeler isn't exactly an old Italian name. It does have certain ties to a Confederate general fighting Joe Wheeler. There's a state park named after him in Northwest Alabama, where I spent many a happy hour once upon a time. But it's not an Italian name that I'm aware of. I don't know, maybe she's married. Maybe her maiden name is Garibaldi or Colombo or something. But she wasn't having any of this business of criticizing Christopher Columbus. Because, of course, she, Liz Wheeler, is a titanic intellect. Having seen enough critiques of Christopher Columbus, she took to Twitter to prove just how breathtakingly stupid she is and said, "Christopher Columbus didn't commit genocide. Within 200 years of Columbus's arrival, 95% of the 20 million Native Americans died from disease, smallpox, flu, tuberculosis, malaria, plague, measles, cholera. Tragic, definitely. But mass murder by Columbus? Not even close. In fact, mass murder, genocide, slavery, war, conquest, child sacrifice was happening in America before Columbus at the hands of native tribes. It could be argued because of the Christian influence Columbus brought to America that those atrocities ended. Happy Columbus Day." God, makes you need a little cold water on the back of the neck and the code. How do you pack so much stupid into one space? Where did the diseases come from, Liz? Flu didn't exist here before 1492. Smallpox didn't. Chickenpox didn't. Measles didn't. Mumps didn't. The common fucking cold didn't. Those are all diseases that developed and evolved as a result of human contact with domesticated and the process of domesticating animals. There's cowpox, chickenpox, smallpox. Anthrax. And they didn't fly across, they didn't just float on currents of air across the Atlantic Ocean. They were brought by white conquerors and colonists. And by the way, that 20 million Native Americans is a way underestimate, too. We now know that, well, I mean, Liz doesn't, because, you know, Liz isn't interested in things like knowledge. These two continents were the most populous continents on Earth in 1491. More than Asia, more than Europe, more than Africa. The malaria, the plague, the measles, the cholera. Yeah, white folks brought that. They brought their guns, they brought their germs, and they brought their steel. Well, fortunately, she didn't get away with it. Because a fellow named Andrew Kimmel, who used to be the head of live video for BuzzFeed, tied into her like a buzz saw. He said his own journals prove otherwise. Why must you lie about everything? And she said, "Well, I'll happily make a correction if you'll provide the evidence. Once you produce it." He responded, "Here are some crumbs, do some journalism. If you support Columbus Day, you support pedophilia. Columbus himself wrote, 100 castellanos are obtained for a woman as easily as a farm, and there are plenty of dealers who go looking for girls. Those of 10 to 12 are especially in demand." Wow, almost sounds like maybe the ancestors of Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein were on the boat. He continued, one of Columbus's men, Bartolome de las Casas, saw so many atrocities he left to become a priest. Quote, such inhumanities and barbarisms were committed in my sight as no age can parallel. My eyes have seen these acts so foreign to human nature that now I tremble as I write. De las Casas, by the way, went on to become what history considers to be the first sociologist, the first social scientist. But, once again, Emery and Marveline, sitting in their matching Barca loungers, having tuned over to Onan, don't know any of this. They only know what they're told by the professional liars at these outlets of mendacity. Note from Kyle, it pisses me off to no end that the media act like Hunter Biden is the most corrupt guy, yet doesn't spend a minute talking about boy wonder Jared Kushner. That fucker's a mess of foreign entanglements, mixing his business interests with the government in an ethical nightmare, and no one says in the media, or the Democratic Party for that matter, says a fucking word about him. Why not? Well, Kyle, I think some people have gotten to the point where they figure you can talk about it all week long and twice on Sunday, and it's not going to make a damn bit of difference because they're going to continue to engage in their grift and their graft and their filth. Jason says, good old airtight two wrongs make a right argument. Airtight. Some catch that catch 22. It's the best there is. But more than ever, I mean, if you want something to look forward to, something to hope for, kind of like when you were a kid and Christmas would roll around and you still dared to dream that one of these days you'd get up and there'd be a pony in the front yard. There never was, but it didn't stop you from hoping. Well, here's something. There's a chance, maybe it's a million to one, or maybe it's a puncher's chance, that eventually we will break that filthy criminal family. Break them, take their wealth, send a bunch of them to prison, so that they can never threaten the American Republic again. Make them, those goddamn Trumps, for once in their miserable, misanthropic existence, work for a living. Instead of sitting and just sucking up the wealth of this nation and never, ever, ever giving anything back in return. On the subject of Bartolome de las Casas, Flavio says, I actually read the 12 volumes of the History of the Destruction of the Indies in Old Spanish, edited by, among others, Lewis Hanke of the University of Texas at Austin, a noted Latin American historian. It is hair-raising stuff. Oh, it is. And he documented it from Hispaniola to Mexico to Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe that was another one. There were two. There's De las Casas and, Bernardo de Sahagún. His work is also seminal on the deliberate destruction of the indigenous population of the continents and islands of the Western Hemisphere. I knew his name would come to me if I thought about it long enough. In particular, he documented the crushing of the brilliant Triple Alliance societies, the Mexica and the other two partners in that alliance. Could be breaking news coming. Nancy Pelosi press conference.
Alone will be marking up H.R. 3, and Mr. Ways and Means Committee, Chairman Neal will be having a hearing on the bill this week and marking it up next week. So we're really going down a path of passing legislation that will be transformative in the lives of the American people for what it will save them and what it will save the taxpayer as well. It might be interesting, do you know that in the course of this past week or so, the Congressional Budget Office reported that H.R. 3 will save taxpayers $345 billion on the Medicare Part D piece alone, and that it will and the Office of the Actuary reported that drug negotiations and Medicare inflation rebates will save households $158 billion and private businesses $48 billion from between 2020 and 2029. So we're very, very proud of the savings that it will be for people in their individual lives, for businesses, and for the taxpayer. It's how we spend that money. Some of it will be used for reinvesting into benefits, making that Medicare a more substantial benefit. Some of it will be for innovation and research at the National Institutes of Health. Some will be for, as I said, about more benefits, whether it's dental, visual, vision, hearing, whatever. With Medicare, I mentioned that, but there are other considerations as well. The committees, as they mark up the bill, we'll make those proposals. The amendment process on the floor will take us to another point, and what are there other ways that we may want to invest some of that money for the benefit of America's working families and for innovation and research. Earlier today, some of you were with us when we had the announcement of Chairman Bobby Scott's College Affordability Act, strong legislation to make higher education more affordable, expanding opportunity, improving access to quality education. This week, as all through the break and continuing this week, we've been working on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. We hope to be on a path to yes. We're still waiting for assurances about enforceability in it, because you can have all the good provisions in the world, but if you can't enforce them, you're just having a conversation. And there are some of the same concerns we have about the U.S.-China relationship. Are they really going to honor any commitments that they make? Buying farm products, that's good, but what about the other considerations that hurt America's manufacturing base and the rest? So we'll see what that is. It seems to me it was a small bill. In terms of guns, again, as I said to some of you earlier, this is a bullet. I was in Florida for It was all over the country, but when I was in Florida, I received this from Frederica Wilson, my colleague. It's a, bracelets are made with bullets in the color orange, which is the color of gun violence protection. This told the president, we're not going away until we get this background check bill passed. But it is just among the other For the People agenda legislation that we have. So legislate, investigate, Mr. Chairman will be here shortly. He'll report on some of that. I just want to say how proud I am of him and the members of the Intelligence Committee for being here over the break for the valuable legislation investigations that they have done. And again, you'll hear from him momentarily. In terms of litigation, we have been very successful in the courts. Last Friday, we won five decisions in our favor in terms of Congress's authority under the Constitution. And today, another decision came down in our favor in relationship to emoluments. You probably have that information on your phones. But again, another recognition that our founders had very deep suspicion about foreigners interfering in our government. and as again in our elections. And the Emoluments Clause was there, put there specifically for that purpose, to protect us from any influence of foreign governments. So the fact that we would be here in an inquiry that relates to the president asking a foreign government to help the president in his reelection by withholding, granting or withholding the timing of military assistance that had been voted on by the Congress is just has so many violations in it. It undermines our national security. We were sending that of military assistance because of Ukraine needing that vis-a-vis Russia. All roads seem to lead to Putin with the president, though, isn't it so? And then when we talk about undermining the integrity of our elections, that's wrong. And when you're talking about violating the president's oath of office to protect, defend, and preserve the Constitution of the United States to the best of his ability, that's the presidential oath, to the best of his ability. Well, we'll go with that. In any event,
ouch. To the best of his ability. Oh, well. That stings. I guess there'll be a twoop storm incoming any time now. She didn't announce a vote on impeachment, on the impeachment inquiry. And you know why? Because she's not stupid. The Republicans are saying, we're not going to order any subpoenas until we have a vote and everybody has to say they approve or disapprove of this. Bullshit. Committees can do what committees need to do as a function of oversight. It does the whole House vote every time a committee undertakes an investigation of, say, whether to... the answer is no. Nancy Pelosi has said, and she is correct, that the Congress has every power it needs to conduct oversight of the executive branch, period. But Jesus, it's getting worse and worse and worse. I think it was Sam Donaldson who spent so many years of his career screaming questions at old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan. He did a TV interview. With CNN. And Donaldson, who's seen a lot of presidents come and go, had the following.
Bye. Sundays at 9.
And we're back now with the breaking news. A CNN source saying that the effort to pressure Ukraine for political help alarmed John Bolton so much that he told an aide to alert White House lawyers that Giuliani was a hand grenade who will blow everyone up. And a source familiar with Fiona Hill's testimony says the former Russia advisor told lawmakers that she was she saw wrongdoing in the Ukraine policy and reported it. Joining me now is Sam Donaldson. Sam, I appreciate you joining us. What do you think of the New York Times reporting tonight?
Well, it's one of those bombshells. It's like poor Donald Trump has the version of the Chinese water torture. Drop, 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 and a final drop breaks his skull. We're just watching this develop, and it's amazing. I mean, I saw the Nixon plumbers operation. That was in the White House. They were the rogue operation. They broke into the Watergate and elsewhere looking for dirt on President Nixon's opponents. But this, according to the Times, is a rogue operation involving the highest officials of the land, the chief of staff of the White House, the president himself, of course. And Bolton wanted to alert the lawyers. What did he expect White House lawyers to do? call the cops, read the president his rights. Donald Trump, you have a right. That may happen someday, not yet, but it's just amazing. And I believe, Don, that this conventional wisdom that we've all thought was right, that there's the House would impeach, but the Senate would never convict with all those Republicans there, may be wrong. I think the Senate could convict if things like this keep going.
Interesting.
How about that? I don't think I'm quite as sanguine as Sam Donaldson is, because I still think that the Republicans in the Senate, one, they're still led by Moscow Mitch McConnell, who has a lot to lose if Trump decides to start spilling the beans on him. Because make no mistake, in the ongoing mischief making coming from Pooty, information will out. A reminder, they hacked the RNC too. They held on to the compromat while using what they had against the DNC. Just, you know, a reminder. Now, former member of the House of Representatives Pete Sessions has received a subpoena and is apparently under investigation over his interactions with Rudy Giuliani and Lev and Igor, help me with the bags. Okay. You get the blonde and I'll take the one with the turban. Never gets old. Lev and Igor. They got a nice roasting on Saturday Night Live this past. Kate McKinnon was brilliant, as she always is, as Rudy Giuliani. And the funny thing is, Sessions got beat in the blue wave of 2018. And so the dirty money that he took availed him not. But, of course, he played a role in trying to get rid of Marie Yovanovitch, who was the ambassador to Ukraine, who is a career foreign service government employee and not a political hack. And then there was this little gem from Lindsey Graham, who got a microphone stuck in his face and just tried to move on as much as he possibly could.
What can you tell us about what your view is at this point of Democrats' impeachment probe? 20 years ago, you said that not complying with the subpoena was an impeachable offense.
Nothing's changed.
Funny, he wasn't quite as loquacious as he usually is. Nothing's changed. And you know what? He was telling the truth. Back then, 20 years ago, he said that for a Democratic president to fail to respond to a Republican subpoena would constitute an impeachable act. Nothing's changed. He still feels that way about Democratic presidents. It's those Republican presidents where the problems crop up, because Lindsey will always put party ahead of country. Because that's just, you know, Lindsey. Let's check in with, Sherman, set the Wayback Machine for 1999, Lindsey Graham.
Article 3 of impeachment against Richard Nixon. The article was based on the idea that Richard Nixon, as president, failed to comply with subpoenas of Congress. Congress was going through its oversight function to provide oversight of the president. When asked for information, Richard Nixon chose not to comply, and the Congress back in that time said, "You're taking impeachment away from us. You're becoming the judge and jury. It is not your job to tell us what we need. It is your job to comply with the things we need to provide oversight over you. The day Richard Nixon failed to answer that subpoena is the day that he was subject to impeachment, because he took the power from Congress over the impeachment process away from Congress, and he became the judge and jury.
Ta-da! And, of course, all that was said in reference to a Democratic president. Yeah. And, of course, it's beneficial to remind ourselves at this point in time that, yes, none other than Mike Pencilneck Geek opined on the issue as recently as, 2008.
This business of high crimes and misdemeanors goes to the question of whether or not the person serving as President of the United States put their own interests, their personal interests, ahead of public service.
Seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it? Yeah, well. So, what Sam Donaldson said is arguably true. Drip, drip, drip. Well, thank you. Flavio says, you do a fabulous Lindsey Graham. Simply fabulous. Flavio's tongue planted firmly in his cheek. let's see. We are into the second hour of the program. We still have $305 to go on fundraising. I do hate mentioning it, but it's the only way this program survives. Brother Deacon Asa says, Jesus, Bob, never in 1,000 years did I ever think I'd live to see a day when John Newcomb Bolton would emerge as the more scrupulous party in the conversation. We're officially living in bizarro world. Yeah, when you've got to, when you got to count on John Bolton for being the straight shooter. Mm. But that's what it's coming down to. Every day, more and more. And now Mick Mulvaney, who is one of the loyal, most loyal of the loyal maggots. He's been so loyal, he got two jobs. He's director of the congressional, Office of Management and Budget. And he's acting chief of staff, because nobody can take the real job. And boy, is he acting. So Fiona Hill testified, and she described a meeting on July the 10th. That meeting included senior Ukrainian officials and John Bolton and other members of the U.S. Embassy staff, as well as Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the European Union. And they raised the issue of digging dirt on Hunter Biden. The Wall Street Journal reporting both Ms. Hill and Mr. Bolton left the meeting with concerns about what had transpired. And Ms. Hill said Mr. Bolton instructed her to talk to the lawyer for the National Security Council, John Eisenberg. Mr. Sondland also appeared to be coordinating his efforts with acting White House Chief of Staff, ta-da, Mick Mulvaney. And I was curious about Gordon Sondland because, well, one, he gave over $1 million to Donald Trump for his inauguration, and in turn was rewarded with the ambassadorship to the EU, having absolutely no diplomatic experience whatsoever. And he's also often described as an hotelier. So I was thinking, you know, who is this guy? Is this the CEO of like Clarion Hotels or Choice Hotels or the Wyndham? Or no. He runs a company that turns old historic buildings into hotels. And there are five. This is the part that amazes me. Maybe amazes is the wrong word. He's primarily centered in the Great Northwest. He's got a bunch of hotels in Portland, a couple in Seattle. He's in business with another hotelier by the name of Kempton, and Kemptons are all over the place. I've stayed in a couple of them. They're kind of nice. Sort of quirky. Malloy and I each had rooms in one up in D.C. One time for one of the protest rally. Yeah, I think that that was the one where I think Tara and I wound up being the wheel team for springing Malloy from jail after he got arrested protesting the illegal wars. Long time ago now. But Gordon Sondland is beginning to waver a little bit because he's realized that Donald Trump's not going to go to bat for him. Donald Trump expects everyone to go to bat for Donald Trump and then to enjoy their skateboard ride under the bus when they're no longer useful. And Gordon Sondland has this notion that he'd like to go on being an respected hotelier after this long national nightmare comes to a conclusion. So here's the question. There's a strong activist base in Portland. Why, and you know, Bob, quit telling us how to behave in Portland. But really, I haven't seen any stories. Maybe it's just it hasn't been properly reported. But why aren't there massive protests in front of these hotels that Gordon Sondland owns? Why aren't people calling for boycotts of these properties? And I ask that because I wonder if it's for the same reason that I just flat didn't know what hotels we were talking about. Or maybe they're the kinds of hotels that are frequented by people who are wealthy maggot types anyway. I mean, Jesus, he's got his own website, GordonSondland.com, that describes him as Portland businessman and philanthropist, a founder of Provenance Hotels, and director and managing member of the Aspen Companies, a diversified private equity firm. He's a hedge funder. We're talking about the Hotel Theodore in Seattle, Washington, the Hotel Murano in Tacoma, the Hotel Deluxe, Hotel Lucia, the Sentinel, the Dossier, and the Heathman Hotel, all in Portland, the Hotel Preston in Nash Vegas, the Old Number 77 and Chandlery in NOLA, New Orleans. The Alexis Hotel was purchased and redeveloped by Sondland. The Alexis in Seattle, alongside Bill Kempton. He's a principal in the Paramount Hotel in Seattle. And he's developing projects through Provenance Hotels in Seattle, Hermosa Beach, California, and L.A., and they specialize in taking old buildings like the Hotel Murano in Tacoma that used to be a conference center Sheraton. Why aren't there protests in front of every one of these filthy places every day? Why not make his life not miserable, but simply accountable for the awfulness that he does? These assholes hear only through their wallets. You could scream at them till you're blue in the face, but it wouldn't matter because they'd just say, well, I'm still rich. Until you do them financial damage, they will not listen, and they damn sure will not learn. Possibly because they're incapable of it. They have been mentally stunted by their recourse to wealth. So if you're out there in the greater Portlandia or Seattle area, look him up. Look at all of his holdings. And then maybe get some of that activist community busy drawing attention to the fact that anyone who stays in one of those properties is enabling a guy who props up a fascist. Ha ha. Well, maybe I was just getting a little vibe from the universe. Mitchell says the names of his hotels have been in the local papers. I believe our congressman Earl Blumenauer, he's a good one, has called to boycott them. Well, if Earl Blumenauer has gotten out and willing to lead the parade. You know, when a politician actually engages in some courage, it's awful helpful if he can get some support. Thanks for letting me know, Mitch. Thank you very much. As to Sam Donaldson earlier, Scott in San Diego says, you know what, Bob? I kind of think I could actually live in a world in which there's the possibility of Mitch McConnell being surprised and disappointed. In fact, something like that could be a refreshing change of pace. I mean, we all know from personal experience that it builds character and gives us a chance to evolve and become better people. Psst! Just between you and me and the Horn family, there's probably no hope for him. But old Sam Plastic Hair Donaldson could well be correct. Well, we can hope that, in fact, Sam Donaldson is correct. And we can hope in one hand and shit in the other and see which one fills up first. Well, thank you, Jim. That's mighty kind of you to say. In spite of your current stressors, Jim says, under the subject line, great intellect, you do a wonderful and incisive job illuminating all you survey, as you always have, Bob. Thank you, Jim. Thank you very, very much. You know, we're coming, we are 9 days away from our anniversary, our birthday here at the Horn. And this has never, I've loved every minute behind this microphone, but it has never been more difficult. And it's not because of y'all, the circumstances we've found ourselves in since January the 20th, 2017 certainly contribute to it, but it's those external stressors that really, really, well, grind, and grind exceeding fine. Cool, Jimmy. Thanks, man. I know of the Theodore and a couple more you mentioned. I'll look into the info you dropped on me. It's awesome when we, as individuals, can engage in the kind of activism that draws people together with a common purpose and one with moral clarity and clear goals. Teach Gordon Sondland to hear through his wallet. You know, maybe simple signs like, if you stay in this hotel, you support Trump. maybe some online activism. Maybe build a boycott movement on social media against Providence hotels. Because I've got a feeling, if you look up the rates, yeah, I've got a feeling that Emery and Marvoline there in their matching Barca loungers, glued to ON or Fox 24/7, I'm guessing they can't afford even one night in one of Gordon Sondland's renovated hotels. That's just my guess. So we're halfway through the program, and I am happy to announce that this being a Tuesday, after having to cope and grieve the passing of his father, Brad Friedman is back with the Green News Report, he and Desi. And I've missed them while they've been gone away this month. And, well, we'll take a little break and see what they've got on the agenda. In the meantime, if you would like to engage in some conversation, well, you can always reach the program through the Stress Line, 844-843-4676. And you can reach the program on Skype. Bob Kincaid Horn works equally well. Jump right in. The conversation is fine. Let's see what Brad and Desi have for us.
It's Tuesday, October 15, 2019. We're back.
While we were out,
we are a wave of change. Together and united, we are unstoppable. And if you belong to that small group of people who feel threatened by us, then we have some very bad news for you.
Big developments in climate science, climate strikes, extreme weather impacts, public lands policy, pollution, pesticides, and more.
All of that straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Pacific Gas and Electric shut off the electricity to 1 million people in case a spark from one of their wires would start a wildfire. How's that for logic? Everybody, stay inside and light dozens of candles in every room, because we don't want to start a fire.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we're back.
Yes.
We were gone for about a month, first time in our 10-year history of the Green News Report that we've ever had to suspend production due to a family emergency, the passing of my father. But we are back, and we've got a month's worth of green news that somehow you're going to fit in to 6 minutes.
Yes, some really, really big stuff happened. Here's just a bit. The Trump administration went to war with the state of California, moving to revoke the state's decades-old special authority under the Clean Air Act, allowing it to regulate tailpipe emissions from cars and trucks. California and 23 other states are now suing. Former oil and gas lobbyist turned Trump Interior Secretary David Bernhardt issued an unprecedented withdrawal of 70 miles of protected public lands along the southern border with Mexico, exempting those lands from federal environmental laws in order to speed up construction of Trump's border wall. Construction crews have already begun bulldozing Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument. The Trump administration proposed a rule to allow mining companies to pay even less in royalties and fees on valuable resources they extract from public lands.
Because, of course, it's the public's money. Naturally, we're giving it away to private companies.
In climate news, September 2019 clocked in as the hottest September on record globally, breaking the September record set just in 2016. So far this year, we've seen the hottest June, the hottest July, the second hottest August, and now the hottest September. Scientists with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a new report with dire warnings on how man-made global warming is rapidly changing the oceans, from accelerating sea level rise to more frequent marine heat waves killing coral reefs to ocean waters becoming more acidic so that animals like oysters can't form their shells. The report also recommended solutions to preserving the ocean ecosystem that begin with acting on climate change. Parts of Houston, Texas were inundated by Tropical Storm Imelda, the worst storm in the state since Hurricane Harvey and one of the wettest tropical cyclones ever recorded in U.S. history. Typhoon Hagibis, the largest storm to hit Japan in decades, over the weekend killed at least 50 people as of airtime and brought record rainfall, landslides, and flooding to Japan that overwhelmed that island nation's flood control infrastructure.
And they're still fighting that one and will be for quite some time.
The Trump EPA proposed new regulations for reducing lead and copper in drinking water, a national public health danger exposed by the Flint water crisis. But critics say the new rules would actually slow down the replacement of the most dangerous water service lines in the United States.
Why am I not surprised?
On Monday, firefighters in California made headway against the biggest wind-driven wildfires raging across the parched state. Officials suggested sanctions against Pacific Gas and Electric, the state's largest electric utility, for its haphazard, badly managed shutoff of electricity to more than a million customers in Northern California. It was intended to prevent its aging equipment from igniting wildfires, but regulators say PG&E deferred critical maintenance for years, instead funneling billions to its shareholders and executives. Economic losses from the disruption could top $2 billion. Scientists warn it could be a preview of how our infrastructure is not ready for the new normal of climate change.
And, of course, what good would sanctions do? They've already declared bankruptcy. They owe billions of dollars. It's time, frankly, for the state to take over that company.
But there was also some good news. Millions of people around the world marched for climate action during the global climate strike in late September, the largest strike yet, inspired by Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg, who excoriated leaders at the United Nations and the U.S. Congress for their failure to take action. Finally, the C40 World Summit of Mayors last week in New York unveiled a playbook outlining high-impact strategies and policies so that cities can act to decarbonize their transportation and building sectors, expand renewable energy resources, and harden their infrastructure in the face of federal inaction. The city of San Jose, California, stepped up first, voting to become the largest city in the United States to ban natural gas from most new home construction.
I'm exhausted just listening to those 6 minutes. Well done, Desi Doyen. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report, because we're back. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And it is good to have them back. Condolences to Brad and his family. Those are hard times indeed. But I've missed two weekly doses of snarky comment over the past month. So welcome back, you two. Note coming from Jim. Wish I could do more, Bob. Please share from my heart. From The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. It is only with the heart that one can see rightly, for that which is important is often invisible to the eye. Deeply true indeed. I just took my handful of ibuprofen. I send a note to Agnes just to keep up with it so that I don't wind up ODing on the stuff. I don't know what happens when you OD on ibuprofen, but I got a feeling it's not fun. But, it's almost enough to make you feel sorry for poor old Flush Flimball, who had such terrible neck pain that he got playing golf with his millionaire buddies, that he went out and got himself hooked on opioids, which he would obtain on the street by sending his maid out with a box full of cold cash in return for a box full of Oxycontins, which he could then chew up for the refreshing burst of flavor. Almost. It would be nice. I was talking with Tracy about this, as a matter of fact. It'd be nice if there was somewhere around here that you could just go and do the occasional massage, because yeah, I'm at a point where I might actually consider that, and I know it would work wonders for Agnes. Yeah, but enough of that. We've got tons more sleaze, tons more slime, tons more scum, because, of course, we live in the era of Trump. You've probably never heard of a cat named Peter Navarro. But there's a publication out there called The Chronicle of Higher Education, and it turned its focus on Peter Navarro. Peter Navarro is a senior economic and trade advisor to Nitwit Nero, and among other things, he's the only guy out there who supports Trump's disastrous trade war with China that is so thoroughly fucking his farmer base. Outside of his world, he's not particularly well known. But as the Chronicle of Higher Education reports, China scholars and fellow economists tend to be less enthused about him. Navarro doesn't have a background in Chinese studies, doesn't speak the language, and reportedly only made his first trip to the country just last year. Justin Wolfers, a professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan, a fine institution, even if despite what the people down at The Ohio State University say, once wrote that Navarro stands so far outside the mainstream that he endorses few of the key tenets of the profession. Tessa Morris Suzuki, emeritus professor of Japanese and Korean history at Australian National University, did an examination of his what she described as his heated language, and says that it bears a remarkable similarity to the yellow peril language of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the kind of rhetoric that led Europe to invade China and take it over until the Chinese wrested it back from them, largely through the efforts of Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai. Okay, so this guy's a jerk. He's a Trump friend. I mean, surprise. Well, you can adding to the fact that he's a jerk, he's also a serial liar. So, and it works this way. So when he writes something, lo and behold, a dude named Ron Vara, who has a background as a, and this is a quote, a military veteran and Harvard-trained economist who made seven figures in the stock market by investing in companies that do well during international crises. Ron Vara chimes in and talks about how star-spangled awesome Peter Navarro is. Here's the punchline. Ron Vara doesn't exist. You know how right-wing military fanboy types get all upset about stolen honor? Well, this is that. Only don't expect them to get upset about this one, because there's only some honor that they get upset about being stolen. There is no Ron Vara. Ron Vara is an anagram of Peter Navarro's last name, Navarro. And so he offers his expert opinion on the things that Peter Navarro has written, only it's Peter Navarro agreeing with Peter Navarro. It all started back in 2001 when this creep wrote a book called If It's Raining in Brazil, Buy Starbucks. And back then, Ron Vara was a doctoral student at Harvard working on a thesis on the regulation of utilities. Well, Tessa Morris Suzuki began seeing Ron Vara's name popping up here and there. And so she called folks at Harvard, said, "You ever heard of this Ron Vara cat?" Everybody said, "Nah, never heard of the guy." They had heard of Peter Navarro, though, because he was working on, oddly enough, a doctoral thesis about utilities regulation about the same time as old Ron Vara was. And Greg Autry, a guy who had been a graduate student under Navarro, eventually dropped the dime. He said, "You're not going to find Ron Vara. He's an Easter egg in Navarro's books, meant to lighten the tone. We do try to have a little bit of fun. If anybody wants to not enjoy that, they're welcome to." Bear in mind that Navarro's books are sold as nonfiction, even though they have fictitious characters in them. Maybe Ron Vara, I'll say this before somebody else chimes in with an email on it. Maybe Ron Vara knows John Barron. Ron in Raleigh says, "Sounds like Peter Navarro's been reading too much Sax Rohmer, if you catch my drift." I'm a little slow. May need a little help on that, Ron. Steve in New York just sent me the story. It caught up to the Washington Post today. We had it on the program last night toward the end of the program, about the British family that accidentally wandered into the U.S. by trying not to hit an animal in the middle of the road, and the fact that they are they've been stuffed in one of Trump's concentration camps, this in the Berks Detention Center in Pennsylvania. Steve says, "No words." I know. Lord, I know. And I guess by now you've heard about Matt Gaetz, who repeatedly was bailed out of DUI charges, I guess because of his daddy's wealth. He's a member of Congress. He has an IQ somewhere around that of stewed prunes. He tried to get into the closed-door hearing where Fiona Hill was testifying, and Adam Schiff wouldn't let him in, which gave Matt Gaetz a big sad. And he then went out before the cameras and had a hissy. Why was he not allowed in the hearing? Well, on the one hand, it's because he wasn't on any of the committees that were holding the hearing. And they were closed-door hearings, which sort of makes sense. No, it makes complete sense. So he had no business in the hearing, except for the fact that he was going to go back and report to Nitwit Nero and, by his presence, try to intimidate Fiona Hill. He complained to the press, "It's not like I'm on the Agriculture Committee." Well, if the Agriculture Committee was holding the hearing, Matt, you goddamned idiot, you'd be in there. But how interesting to... Maybe the farmers in Florida would like to know the low esteem in which Matt Gaetz holds the Agriculture Committee, which in turn holds the very existence of so many Florida farmers in their hands. It's not like I'm on the Agriculture Committee. No, you're on the DUI Committee, Matt. What a moron. That must have really chapped his ass to get thrown out by Adam Schiff. Ah, there we go. Okay. Yellow Peril, Ron in Raleigh says, really? Yeah, I'm a little slow tonight, Ron. Sax Rohmer, author of the quintessential Yellow Peril novels featuring Fu Manchu, the man, not the mustache. Aha. Oh, something for me to add to my list. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate the clarity. Hi, Clarity. Oh, and you know how Trump said to
Lev and Igor, I've never heard of them, don't know them. You got to ask Rudy about that.
Allie was lying again. According to Politico on Saturday, a photograph of President Donald Trump posing with a recently indicted associate of Rudy Giuliani was posted online in April 2014. In the photo, Trump and Lev Parnas stand shoulder to shoulder, smiling at the camera at what appears to be an outdoor nighttime event. Trump wears a white Trump-branded cap and white shirt under a jacket. Parnas wears a royal blue collared shirt. And April 2nd, 2014. Never heard of him. Wouldn't know him if I saw him. Wouldn't know him if I was standing in a photograph with him. Oh, wait. God damn it. Then there was something else that happened over the weekend, because these people just can't fucking help it. Representative Brian Mast, a maggot from Florida, on Sunday morning, tweeted, "Congratulations to the United States Navy," because it was founded on, let's see, this 14th. October the 13th, 1775. So Representative Brian Mast tweets, "Happy birthday, U.S. Navy." Trump retweeted it for a moment, and then it miraculously disappeared. Well, there's only one problem with "Happy birthday, U.S. Navy," Brian Mast, U.S. Congress. The naval vessel shown in it is not, say, a Nimitz-class carrier or one of our high-dollar Aegis cruisers or frigates, whatever they are. It's not even one of our ballistic missile nuclear submarines. No. It's a battle cruiser. Kind of sits low in the water, superstructure in the middle, high pointed prow, lower fantail deck at the stern. Pretty nifty looking ship. Something to really be proud of if you're a member of the Russian Navy. Because that the photo tweeted by Representative Brian Mast, maggot of Florida, is the Russian battle cruiser Pyotr Veliki. Mm-hmm. If you want to wish happy birthday to the United States Navy, how about a picture of the oldest remaining commissioned United States naval vessel? The Constitution, which sits in Boston Harbor and is not at all hard to find a photograph of. about which the father of Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., who was a Brahmin in mid-century Boston, became very distraught when plans were announced to scrap the USS Constitution. He got so distraught that he wrote a poem. That's what distraught Brahmins did back then. I memorized it when I was a kid. It just moved me to no end. I tear her tattered ensign down, long as it waved on high, and many an eye has danced to see that banner in the sky. Beneath it rung the battle's shout and burst the cannon's roar. The meteor of the ocean air shall sweep the clouds no more. Her deck once red with heroes' blood, where knelt the vanquished foe, when winds were hurrying o'er the flood and waves were white below, no more shall feel the victor's tread or know the conquered knee. The harpies of the shore shall pluck the eagle of the sea. Oh, better that her shattered hulk should sink beneath the wave. Her thunders shook the mighty deep, and there should be her grave. Nail to the mast her holy flag, set every threadbare sail, and give her to the god of storms, the lightning and the gale. That poem was almost single-handedly responsible for the fact that Old Ironsides, the USS Constitution, sits to this day commissioned, staffed by United States naval officers and enlisted crew. And they take her out and sail her around every now and then just to make sure her old bones don't get too rickety. Her timbers originally were transported over land and over rivers from about 10 miles from where I now sit in a place called Nallon, West Virginia. Her copper plating was produced under contract with Paul Revere's shop. But of course, there is a connection between the United States and the Russian Navy. There would be no Russian Navy were it not for the United States. How about that? Ain't history cool? John Paul Jones, having built himself a little bit of fame with a ragtag navy during the American Revolution, was hired, I guess you could say, as a mercenary, or maybe today we would say a consultant, by Catherine the Great, Tsar of Russia, to come and build her a modern navy fit to ply the seas alongside the dominant navy of the time, that of Great Britain, as well as the navies of France and Spain. And that he did. But still, that's really not a good reason to wish the United States Navy happy birthday with an image of the Pyotr Veliki. Jim says, oh my lord, happy birthday Navy. Peter the Great must be very pleased, Bob. Jesus. Some 22-year-old staffer probably in charge of Brian Mast's social media probably did that. Yeah, Brian Mast probably couldn't figure out how to use Twitter if his life depended on it. That's why, like novels of Jonathan Swift, that's why people like Brian Mast have what Swift referred to as flappers. In one of Gulliver's Travels, he happens upon a band of people on an island whose leaders have people around them who do nothing but flap their mouths for them. Well, that's what a social media specialist is. A Swiftian flapper. But you'd think the kid could have at least looked up. That's what I want to know. What kind of a search are you performing where you wind up with an image of a Russian battle cruiser and you think it's a United States Navy vessel? Is it because the pennant flying off the stern is really, really tiny and you can't see that it's one red stripe, one white stripe, and one blue stripe? You can't make out the 13 alternating red and white stripes and the 50 stars. Is that it? Hey, wow, thanks a bunch. Thanks, our buddy Lottie sent along a photo from long, long ago now, my one trip to Boston, standing dockside. We weren't able to go aboard the Constitution. She was undergoing maintenance. But Lottie got a picture of me standing with the Constitution in the background. Thank you, Lottie. That's awesome. I built models of the Constitution when I was a kid. I started out with a small one, and eventually I built the 36-inch-long, fully rigged, painted everything version. And one of my little nieces came along one day, not long after it was done, and said, "Oh, pretty boat." Picked it up and, million pieces. My heart broke. Very nice note coming in from Alec in the UK. "Hi, Bob. Love the show. Your perspective is spot on. We have shit leadership, if you can call it that, here as well. Power and money in the hands of our leaders have corrupted the direction of the Western nations to a point where something's going to snap real bad somewhere soon. These leaders that put profit above the environment are on the wrong side of the future. They will eventually go down in history as environmental criminals. We need to get rid of the lot ASAP somehow. In my country, the Conservative Party state that they're the party for reduced emissions. In the recent leadership challenge, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt both used separate choppers to the same destinations every day for a month. What an example. I won't even get into the lies of Brexit, but thinking of you guys over there, fingers crossed. The fight for freedom is a tough one. Also, I'm disgusted with the torture of our citizens for crossing into the U.S. Oh my God, what the fuck? Thought we were on the same side. I feel so sad for the good people of the U.S. and the U.K. We got some struggles on our hands, Alec. We absolutely do. And thank you for your kind note. It's great to hear from you. And thanks for staying up late to listen. I know how that those time zone thingies work. That just tickles me pink. But it is as though we have a winnowing of leadership, and the fact is, the money has ruined everything. I mean, there was a time, I know a little bit, I can't name all the kings or anything, and queens, but I know there was a time similar to this. I would dare say it is similar. If you go back in British parliamentary history and you look to that time, William Pitt was revered, but for every William Pitt, there's a Lord North. And historically speaking, the United States and the revolution that formed it didn't have to happen. It was created out of a bumbling wealth class that just happened to get their hands on the reins of power and were complete amateurs about it. Yeah, it was in the U.S., we tend to look at the U.S. side of the American Revolution, but there was a shitstorm, and I would dare say a shitstorm that is more comparable than most people would be comfortable with in Parliament that made the conditions ripe for the American Revolution. And of course, you have to remember that a very small percentage of people here actually wanted revolution. They considered themselves Englishmen and women, and they damned well wanted to stay that way. One of the heartbreaks of the revolution is the fact that Benjamin Franklin's own son Ben pretty much, oh God, history rhymes, it's rhyming again. I guess the for-profit media would be losing their tiny minds if we had them back in the day, because Benjamin Franklin got his son the job of royal governor of the New Jersey colony. I mean, there was no doubt about it. It wasn't so much a quid pro quo, but the crown knew Ben. Ben said, I got a good boy here, make a good governor. And the crown said, make it so. But Ben's boy remained a loyalist and a Tory. And Ben felt like independence was the way to go. And they never spoke again. That had to be heartbreaking. And his son, I think, when everything played out, crossed the Atlantic and lived out the remainder of his days in England. That estrangement. I don't know why my mind looped around to that. Maybe it has to do with present circumstances. But if you take a historical look at the British parliaments of the 1750s, 1760s, and into the 1770s, you can see a real result. I'm not sure who it's insulting more, Lord North or Boris Johnson, to compare those two. But they were both hopelessly inept and ill-suited to the task at hand. And as you feel for us, Alec, I feel for you and the decent people of the UK who are about to watch October 31st come on and are probably sweating the what-ifs more than I can even describe. Did I say months ago, Sparky? I meant years. I meant years ago. Years and years. I'm trying to think. God, I think it might have been 2012. That photograph. Brother Deacon Asa says, it sounds like it's not just the Russian and Turkish accent the maggots can't tell from one another. The dumbasses couldn't tell if those were Ruski alphabets on the goddamn ship or Merkin ones. To be fair, and I'm zooming here, I cannot see any numbers or letters. There is a radar thingy about two-thirds of the way back that looks an awful lot like the Russian double eagle, but I probably see that in everything. Our buddy, Jug of Punch, says, did Chris Hayes grow a spine because of Shep Smith's firing? A paycheck is a nice thing to have. P.S. Shep is a horrible person. He willingly worked for Rupert Murdoch. There's that. But Chris has been pretty spiny all along. Shep wasn't fired. He did ask to be let out of his contract because he was sick of having to, among other things, get in seventh grade slap fights with Tucker fucking Carlson. I can see where that would get tiresome, too. It's part of the reason that I don't invite right-wingers to come on this program and argue. They are simply not worth the precious, finite time of my existence. Just not. Let them go and shriek and hoot and holler their maggot nonsense elsewhere. Greatest economy in the history of the world! Chickens have a way of coming home to roost. Yeah. And by the way, it's not just that John Bolton said, you might want to call the lawyers on this one. Apparently, he became infuriated. Mustache on fire, angry. Within minutes of the Ukraine call's aftermath, senior officials, including Bolton, were being pinged by subordinates about problems with what the president had to say to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Bolton and others scrambled to obtain a rough transcript that was already being locked down on the highly classified computer network. One person familiar with the sequence of events said, when people were listening to this in real time, there were significant concerns about what was going on. Alarm bells were kind of ringing. People were trying to figure out what to do, how to get a grasp on the situation, which is Washington speak for how to remain unindicted. But at least some people are talking. Fiona Hill, Marie Ivanovich. I imagine at some point in time, Bolton is going to be called. And all of this is, well, what's the, it's stoking the stroke. The people who are talking are on the way to probably triggering a transient ischemic attack in Nitwit Nero from Twitter.
Democrats are allowing no transparency at the witch hunt hearings. If Republicans ever did this, they would be excoriated by the fake news. Let the facts come out from the charade of people, most of whom I do not know. They're interviewing for 9 hours each, not selective leaks.
The charade of people. Charade. Pigman, pigman. Ha ha. Sherrod, you are. You know who testified for 11 hours and never broke a sweat? Hillary Clinton. You know who can't make it? Who can't make it 2 minutes? Rudy Giuliani. You know who wasn't allowed to test to give any kind of anything other than his little Crayola on construction paper statement to Robert Mueller, because every lawyer from sea to shining sea that was associated with Trump knew that he would commit perjury or some form of false swearing within a matter of time that as yet is incalculable by the most sensitive of scientific chronometric equipment, like nanoseconds. Yeah, that'd be Donald Trump. Don't worry, Nitwit Nero, you're going to get your transparency. And you'll get it by the bucketful. Other maggots are losing their shit over what's going on in Syria. Her name was Hevrin Khalaf. She was co-chair of the Syrian Future Party. She's the woman who was shot while riding in her vehicle, had her body dragged from the car, raped and stoned, according to some reports. It was described by state-run media in Turkey as a successful operation to neutralize Ms. Khalaf. Brett McGurk, whose last name, I apologize, it's just the way my mind works, sounds like a character from a Dr. Seuss story. Well, at one point in time, he was the number one guy in charge of operations aimed at defeating ISIS, ISIL, Islamic State, Daesh, whatever you want to call the gang of homicidal religious maniacs. He described the killing of Ms. Khalaf as a war crime. And he had been a loyal maggot. I wonder if he's got enough courage to say in the name of his country that he professes to love that the only way that we survive is by peacefully and legally removing Donald Trump from office and forbidding him from ever holding elected office again. Because that is a consequence of impeachment and conviction. Just got to figure out a way to make that apply to his disgusting spawn as well. Another former member of the military, this one a Democrat, Arizona Democrat Ruben Gallego, a Marine who served in Iraq early in the illegal war against Iraq. He didn't hide his light under a bushel.
Do you have any idea why he would do this? Because if Republicans are coming out, they've been silent on everything else Trump does. They're going actually very full-throated here criticizing Trump on this issue.
I mean, honestly, it's just because he's really stupid. I mean, he's one of the dumbest presidents in the history of this country. And I don't think he realized the impact of what he was doing when Erdogan got on the phone with him and tried to put pressure on him. And I think everyone was going to want to try to like think that this man's playing three-dimensional chess. He's not. And that's the most dangerous thing, is that he is going about everything when it comes to foreign policy in such a haphazard manner that it actually is dangerous. And he's not listening to his advisors. And, you know, he's more focused on him than the country.
I mean, are you fearful there could be not a true genocide, but a wholesale slaughter of people in northern Syria now who are no longer defended, that women and children could be killed as well because of this policy of Trump?
I'm like, the Turkish government, Erdogan, have been waiting for this opportunity for years. They've been asking for this opportunity for years. They would love nothing more than to create even a further buffer between them and the Kurds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the end, let's not forget that the Turkish government, Erdogan, were not very helpful for us. They allowed ISIS to basically use Turkey as a transportation point into Syria for many years. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't shut down for many years. The only reason it was eventually shut down is because the Kurds actually went with our assistance to actually push and cut off their access to move north and south through Syria, northern Syria. So this is, you know, this is just a tragedy. It's a tragedy for us on a huge scale.
And by the way, the questioner there is Dean Obadala, a nice young man who works over at that network that is run by Trump loyalists, despite the fact that they have a progress channel headed by someone who knows absolutely nothing about radio. But Dean does good work, definitely. I appreciate the candor. One of the dumbest histories in the president, one of the dumbest presidents in the history of this country, says Ruben Gallego. I would differ with him only in the idea that he's one of the dumbest presidents. He is the dumbest president. He is the weakest link. He makes Warren Gamaliel Harding look like Albert Einstein. He makes W look remotely, vaguely non-stupid. I mean, we've had some bad ones. James Buchanan comes to mind. But none of them, and all of them combined, can't touch Nitwit Nero. Oh, and by the way, going back to our conversation about Precious Lindsay getting punked by the Moscow 97.5 Morning Zoo Crew DJs. Yeah, Pootie listens to them every morning and just slaps his thighs, guffawing at their hijinks. You might recall part of that recording had to do with the sensitivity of an Iranian-born gold bug who was in deep shit with the Department of Justice. Reza Zarab, Iranian and Turkish. A client, by the way, of none other than Rudy Giuliani. Well, it turns out that Chlamydia Claudius told Rex Tillerson, one day you're the head of one of the largest corporations on earth, and the next thing you know, you're being fired by a guy who sells meat through the mail. He told Rex Tillerson to lean on the Justice Department to drop the criminal investigation of Reza Zarab. Tillerson responded that he wouldn't do it because it would be unethical to interfere in the investigation. Zarab got busted in 2017, convicted over the part that he played in a billion-dollar bribery scheme to the Turkish finance minister in order to circumvent U.S. sanctions on Iran, and he got 32 months in the federal stir. Quid pro quo? Pourquoi? Yeah. And here we are, almost 2.5 hours into the program. Thank you very kindly to Anatole for meeting Steve's challenge. We got $305 to finish fundraising. It'll be $505 for prayer meeting Wednesday if we don't knock down a little bit of it this evening. It sure would be nice if we could. Oh, I understand now. Lottie sent Sparky that picture years ago. Okay, got it. Thank you, Sparky. All clear now. Just a gentle reminder that the maggots out there, they're not all talking about impeachment. Some of them are still angry about that one that for 8 long years was in our White House. Friends and neighbors, because it's Titanic Tuesday, Scott Lively.
When I went through that 50-seat...
Wait, time out. I know that's a little roomy and echoey, but try to bear with it. Scott Lively, you're going to want the hockey puck, okay?
Tour of the Soviet Union, I pitched the idea to them. I said, look, the only way that you're really going to stop this, and what we should have done in the United States, is you have to ban gay propaganda to children, right? That was what my last city was St. Petersburg. I published a letter to the Russian people, and I laid that out as one of my recommendations. And sure enough, a few years later, St. Petersburg became the first city to actually adopt a ban on gay propaganda to children. And then it was picked up by a few other cities, and then it became national law. In 2013, right? And that, if you look at your chronology, that's when Obama pulled the pin on the reset and instead went after to restart the Cold War intentionally, running a coup to take out the pro-Russian president in Ukraine, knowing that the Russians had absolutely no choice but to annex the Crimea because of their strategic interest there. It'd be like if Hawaii decided to secede from the U.S., we would never allow it. And then it was also Obama could then point the finger at Russia, blame them as the aggressors, and prevent Eastern Europe from moving back over to the Russian Federation because they were all going to adopt the Russian ban on gay propaganda to kids. There were 5 of them lined up to do it, including Ukraine. And Obama, I believe Obama, is a homosexual activist. He's not just pro-gay. Right. He's gay himself. This is the most important issue to him. And the sexual revolution is the most important issue to the globalists. And so this was absolutely essential to them to prevent the Russians from being able to get any favor with American conservatives or with the Eastern Europeans. That's why. And how does that tie in with anything today? As soon as they took down Ukraine, they all rush in, and Biden's son Hunter becomes the bag man to receive all the money, right? Because they take over the oil fields, the gas fields in Ukraine, right?
Never in my life have I prayed so hard for a Thorazine dart to come flying out from off screen and just right in Scott Lively's neck. That is some serious crazy horse shit. But it passes for serious foreign policy over on the White Wing. Barack Obama, gay guy. Now, Scott Lively is, of course, fairly well known in those circles for being a maggot and a radical homophobe and bigot. But here's the funny thing. He wasn't just yelling on top of while standing atop a soapbox on a corner somewhere. He was invited, paid, to show up and speak to something called the Oklahoma Conservative Political Action Committee. They walk among us. That's all you can really say. I didn't quite get whether or not Hunter Biden's gay, too. Jesus. The amount of time that be nice if Scott Lively would go ahead and get caught with a man in his mouth and have to shut the fuck up. Because you know. regarding the photo. Look at my new sailboat. James in Illinois says, at least you didn't say the other day. Like I said, I'm not on top of my game right now. I'm not. Doing my best. Trying. Let's run over to the stress line and see who we've got. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's me, Reggie, from Decatur, Georgia, yet once again. And I heard you talk, well, I heard your podcast, rather, talk about some sort of terrorism about a video yesterday that you talked about. That fake Trump video about somebody, about him killing his, shall we say.
Yeah, it's from the 2014 enemies. Movie Kingsman. It's the church massacre scene, and some Russian trolls doctored it to make it look like he was murdering the media and a few notable celebrities, including Hillary Clinton setting Bernie's hair on fire and murdering him, and Mika Brzezinski. I think he murders Rachel Maddow. Yeah. And by the way, there's a follow-up to that, Reggie.
Right. What's the follow-up, Bob? And before you get to that, what did you call it again? Some terrorism?
Stochastic. S-T-O-C-H-A-S-T-I-C. Stochastic terrorism. That is the use use of media to trigger someone randomly to engage in a terroristic act.
Well, doesn't Hate Talk Radio fall within that category? Yes or no?
Sure it does. Sure it does. The best example being years ago, when Glenn the Beckerhead Beck railed about the Tides Foundation for days, weeks on end, until he finally got somebody who was soft enough of mind to load a bunch of guns in his car and head to San Francisco because he was going to murder the Tides Foundation, and the only saving grace being that he had to drink himself a bottle of liquid courage before he could do it, and he got popped for DUI. Not so much luck with Kill O'Reilly, I mean Bill O'Reilly, who railed against Dr. Tiller, referring to him as Tiller the Killer, until somebody else with a soft enough mind and enough bullets and a rifle slaughtered Dr. Tiller in the very church where he served as an usher or a deacon or something along those lines for nothing more than helping women exercise their constitutional rights. And then there's the guy, Jim David Atkinson, who was motivated and weaponized by the stochastic terrorism of Bernie Goldberg, Bill O'Reilly, Michael Savage, Sean Hannity, and went in and committed a massacre during a children's play production of Annie at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Knoxville, Tennessee. Stochastic terrorism, right, Reggie, is very, very real.
Right. Well, what can we do to stop it, Bob? Was it already falling too late? Or has the pendulum?
Well, you have to call it out. The key, right, the first thing, is to call it out.
Right.
And the second thing is to make sure people know what it is, explain it clearly enough that people can understand.
Right.
And thirdly, when organizations like YouTube, which received a massive number of complaints on this damn thing,
right,
YouTube refused to pull it because they said it was comedy. They said it was humorous.
Well, wait a minute. Yeah, murder is
And they additionally said that it could never happen in real life.
Bullshit. What do you think, Bob?
Oh no! Yeah, bullshit, it's absolute bullshit. But it's also what we've learned to expect from the social media corporate giants, because frankly, they're quietly in favor of Donald Trump because, just like Les Moonves said, Donald Trump isn't good for he may not be good for America, but he's great for CBS, and he's great for YouTube, and he's great for Google, and he's great for Twitter, and he's great for Facebook.
Right. Starting with the one giant conglomerate corporation that got its name from a certain animal, you know, the blank and the hound.
Yeah. Yeah, the blank in the hen house. Yeah.
Yeah, the blank in the hen house. Fox News Channel. They started all of this. And now you got the other three, I don't know, limping along with them, silently. Muzzled and gagged, I guess. They're like lemmings. Why don't they call this shit out? Throw this bullshit out, as some of them have. I'm sure Shepard Smith called it out before or after he quit.
Well, first of all, you can't use a word like stochastic over on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda, because Emery and Marvelline won't be able to find it, because Emery and Marvelline don't have a dictionary, and Emery and Marvelline depend on Fox News to tell them what to think, how to think it, when to think it, and most importantly, to not think at all, but rather simply believe everything they see and hear on Fox News TV Radio Rwanda.
Mind control? Is that it? Mind control by Fox News?
Well, propaganda. It's just propaganda.
Yeah, that too. Right. Has the other networks called this stuff out? The other three that I mentioned?
Well, CNN, CNN was early on this, demanding a denunciation of it, which was tepid and half-hearted at best, coming from the White House. Like I said, they really didn't dare show it to Trump, because he would have loved it, and he probably would have retweeted it and talked about the very fine people who made it.
Right. But what about the other one, MSNBC?
Well, I don't have time to monitor them all. There was it got airplay yesterday.
I bet it did. I just bet it did.
And there was some, there was some hand-wringing and pearl-clutching.
From Joe and Mika?
Oh, no, not a peep.
What about Rachel?
Didn't see.
I'm sure she talked about it. Huh?
I didn't see. Maybe somebody...
Oh, right. Yeah. But you said Joe and Mika were like robots. Mindless, soulless, emotionless. It didn't faze them, as it should human beings. As you very well know, Bob Burner is neither comedic, funny, nor humor. Nor fun. Right, Bob?
Right. Absolutely.
And we should stop this before millions of people are killed. Or should I say billions? We got to stop it at the root, at the source,
Well, what Alex said, right? What Alex said in his email a few minutes ago struck me.
Yeah.
Let me go back and find the precise language.
And I'm sure another Alex, no relation, has stirred this up too. Last name Jones.
Well, yeah, he's been kind of laying low lately because he got himself in such deep shit, losing losing all those legal battles for the filthy things that he did to the Sandy Hook parents.
Well, what about the peak? Go ahead.
Alec, writing from the UK a little bit ago, said, power and money in the hands of our leaders have corrupted the direction of the Western nations to a point where something's going to snap real bad somewhere soon. And that immediately reminded me of something we talked about on this program 2 or 3 years ago. It was an article, and I wouldn't even begin to know how to find it again. But it was an article about, maybe it was at The Guardian, I'm not sure. But it was an article about how the worst things that ever happened to humanity never start with a really big thing. They start with little things. A rat, a rat going down a rope line of a ship docked in Venice in 1345 or something. The murder of an archduke in Sarajevo. A boycott put on the Empire of Japan over their invasion and rape and murder of China.
Right.
Little things. Well, the reason yesterday was Columbus Day.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is, the reason that Columbus wanted to sail west to get to Asia
right.
was because the Portuguese, beginning with, I believe, Prince Henry the Navigator, had
right.
Had established a trade route around the Horn of Africa, and they damned well were not going to tolerate any Spanish caravels working their corner. So the Spanish wanted some of that sweet, sweet Asian trade, and they and,
right.
And Columbus, who was a maniac, convinced them, and it's not like they thought the world was flat. That's a damn myth. But,
right.
the world being round had been proven in Egypt during the reign of the Ptolemies in the last couple of centuries BCE. But
right.
Columbus thought the world was smaller than it was, and he didn't know that there was an entire pair of continents in the way. And
right.
so it was just a little thing whereby they were trying to get a competitive trade imbalance, and
right.
it wound up with millions of indigenous people dying.
Right.
And the institution of slavery and kidnap and rape in the New World, the importations of slaves from Africa into the New World, right?
Right.
Little things cause great disasters.
Mm.
And that's what's been so nerve-wracking over the course of the last, since January 20th, 2017, is that we're one dumbass tweet away from a nuclear holocaust. We are one
right.
we are one idiot's tweet away from genocides, from ecocides.
Right.
From an extinction level event for our species because of one stupid, evil, venal man.
Right, that's true. I wonder what the pig man, a.k.a. Jabba the Hutt, but that's what Mike Malloy calls him, the pig man,
you know,
a.k.a. Jabba the Hutt. Well, I wonder was he siding on this, or was he bitching about it yesterday?
No, he knows where his bread's buttered.
So he squealed like a pig.
No, he's still solid maggot.
Who, Rush Limbaugh? The pig man, as Mike Malloy would call him?
Yeah.
Why you say that, Bob?
Because he is.
But he wasn't squealing about this? Oh, he is.
Yeah, he's
he wasn't squealing about this.
He's thoroughly in Nitwit Nero's corner.
Right. In his corner, his pocket, and wherever else he could be put at.
Well, it's good for business. Again, it all comes down to capitalism, Reggie.
Right. That's
they don't care what happens to America as long as he keeps making the $50 million a year.
Oh, you mean Rush, right?
Yeah.
Him and everybody else that's in conservative hate talk radio, right?
Right, sure. As long as the check clears. If we could translate that into Latin, it would be the motto of not just right-wing media, but all for-profit media. As long as the check clears.
Or the check's in the mail. Oh, that's right. You've been railing against them. You've been ranting and raving about against them for years, Bob. You wish that they could be, shut down or at least take the ads out.
I want the profit motive taken out of news divisions.
Right. But, it wasn't always like this, Bob, right? And I was
to one extent or another, it has always been like this. Edward R. Murrow arguing for journalistic integrity in the 50s
right.
and the horrible journalism, quote-unquote journalism, practiced by the likes of Hearst and Pulitzer.
Right.
An irony that we have a Pulitzer Prize for journalism and that prize is supposed to represent the very Everest of journalistic achievement and integrity. And it was funded and founded by a publisher who engaged in the worst kinds of bullshit journalism.
Right. But what about people like this, such as the late great Walter Cronkite, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, and Dan Rather?
Well, I'm not sold on Tom Brokaw.
What about the other three?
Cronkite, you know.
Yeah, Cronkite.
Cronkite was kind of a, you know, he knew Murrow, and they had and they had dedications to News First, and they fought to keep the pernicious influence of money in the news business as at bay as they possibly could. They were not entirely successful. I had this conversation weeks ago, I think, with Scott in San Diego. The fact of the matter is, everything changed when Rune Arledge, when Rune Arledge, who had masterminded ABC's Wide World of Sports, was put in charge of the news division, and he was hailed as an innovator, when in fact what he did was begin the long, slow slide into irrelevance and inanity that grips the for-profit media, news media today. Another person along that journey is someone that I've admired deeply over the years, and that's Ted Turner. Ted Turner invented the 24-hour news cycle with all the best intentions in the world, and then got himself screwed out of control of CNN, at which point it promptly went to shit.
Right.
But, I mean, you can ask Malloy. He was there in the early days of CNN. So was I. And and it was an entirely different organization.
Right. Which he created from scratch, from the bottom up. Ted Turner did.
Yeah, because he was sick and tired of watching what the news had become in the wake of the entertainmentization of it, pioneered by Rune Arledge.
Right. But what about Dan Rather and Mike Wallace? I would say Tim Russell, but you don't like him very much.
No, they did good work. Rather still does good work. Rather got rat-fucked and thrown under the bus by his own network over a filthy piece of fake news of its day that was engineered and orchestrated by Turd Blossom, you know, Karl Rove.
Right. It was about George W. Bush, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the Texas Air National Guard, and him being a chicken shit AWOL.
Right. What about the other two?
I don't know, Reggie. I mean, I'm not gonna sit here and just opine on every retired TV news anchor. I mean, personally, I think the far better journalists are the ones who work in voices or words.
Because
radio or print, because TV does not afford you, especially in this era, the space you need to really, really drill deep into any topic. You can't give full coverage to a topic in 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Right, that's true.
Even the network news as it used to exist, where you had bureaus and reporters on the ground all over the place, that's gone, and it's been replaced by people who sit around a table and talk about shit because they're and give their opinions as opposed to facts. I've grown very tired of it, and we don't need to cite any examples. But Reggie, I got to get out of here, man. We're running out of time. So we'll talk again soon, all right?
All right, Bob.
All right. See you, Reggie.
Have a good night and keep warm.
Thanks.
Have a good night and keep warm, man, because it's getting cooler now. it's fall.
Oh, we're down. Yeah, we've touched into the 30s now, and it's kind of see your breath in the morning in the bedroom now. It's gonna might be a long winter. Take care, Reggie.
Oh, wait a minute, but what are you planning on doing for Halloween this year?
I don't know. Bridge Day is Saturday, so that's where my attention is focused right now.
Okay, man.
All right, later. That's our buddy Reggie calling from the greater Atlanta area. Yeah, it is Bridge Day on Saturday. The largest single-day festival in West Virginia. In arguably the coolest place to be in West Virginia. There'll be a lot of great food. Probably there'll be a chili cook-off. There'll be awesome music. And 100,000 people standing on a single arch bridge extending 876 feet over the canyon floor below where flows the second oldest river on planet Earth. I don't know that we'll walk out. We might walk out onto the bridge. It gets so claustrophobic out there. And I do not envy the people who have to, the sheriff's deputies and the state police and the FBI uniformed police and the National Guard and whatnot who have to provide security for that thing. I mean, you can't bring a backpack. You can't bring nothing. Nothing. You can wear clothes. I saw where one woman was saying, listen, I got a baby. I can't carry a diaper bag. And they said, hey, it's entirely at the discretion of the officer doing the inspection. But I'd be prepared to stash it somewhere before you get onto the bridge. Because, see, in our coward nation, C-O-W-E-R-E-D, not C-O-W-A-R-D, in our coward nation, we are still waiting for the big terrorist attack. But in 2019, the far greater threat comes from homegrown white wing terrorism. You know, some maggot with his freedom protector. But apparently they will have wands and they will be doing pat downs and they'll be doing metal detector stuff. Complicated term, technological term, metal detector stuff. In hopes that, you know, nobody gets out there with any. The only people who get onto the bridge with backpacks are the people who are going to jump off the bridge with those backpacks which have parachutes in them. Still on their back. You might look online if you want to see any of the madness, but it'll be fun and it's a great walk. Hopefully the grandbabies will be over and we'll have a merry and wonderful time. And thanks very kindly to Alec. Alec just jumped in on our fundraiser, or on the evening's fundraising, and we've crossed under the $300 mark. Thank you, Alec. That takes us down to 355, no, 255. Told you, I'm not at my best, but we're at 255 for the evening. That'll make us 455 tomorrow. Thank you so much, Alec, and thank you, Anatole, earlier for meeting Steve's challenge, and thank you, Steve, for making it. So 250. So we'll be at 455 tomorrow. Thank you very much indeed. So we've got a few minutes left in the program, but I think I'm just going to knock off and hopefully be asleep before not too long and get up and do whatever tomorrow requires me to do. And who knows what that'll be. Oh, and I want to send out thanks to our buddy Suman. Suman sent me a lovely leather-bound journal from a recent trip that he took to Italy. It came from Florence. And thank you so very much for that, Suman. it will be put to good use. And thanks to all of you who keep the program going, subscribing or a la carte. Thank you so very much. Thanks to all of you who share your precious time engaging in the program, no matter how you so do. Glad to have you as part of the community. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. And I love you, son. Later, y'all.